This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris and I've got Julian Ng here with me. Good morning, Jules.
Good morning.
6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 21st of September. We've got a great show lined up for you because today on the show, Vitrox Berhad, they are in the semiconductor and electronics industry, a player there. What they do exactly, Jules, is that they design and manufacture machine vision products. And
machine vision.
Yeah, and then they sell it to the semiconductor industry. So I went to check out what this machine vision products is. It sounded really sci-fi to
me.
Yeah,
it's like seeing machines.
Yes. Essentially what it is just a kind of conveyor belt, so line production. But they do 3D scanning and they basically inspect the products for any kind of faults or failures, right?
So yet another factor that would put humans out of job.
I know, and it's really quite fascinating because the way they've done it is to make it super efficient so the semiconductor industry can, you know, just kind of automate this, make sure that there's no faulty parts in this tiny little chip.
That's amazing.
Because, I mean, to the human eye, you won't be able to notice any flaws, right? So they've got kind of a 3D scanner to do this. And it's a very niche industry. And I'm just wondering, can something that niche be, essentially grow, right? Where else are you going to grow? You're dependent on how the semiconductor industry does.
Well, I think that this kind of thing is also along the lines of the trend of self-driving cars and other automated system. This is just part of that big trend moving towards this. It's a juggernaut. And you have the Internet of Things as well, where your fridge would talk to your phone and tell you to order a carton of milk, for example. You know, that's what's happening.
For me, my favorite example of the Internet of Things is in the aviation industry. And I think it was because I found out about the Internet of Things within the aviation industry after MH370.
Okay.
So what I find particularly fascinating is that parts in the engine can talk to other parts in the engine and tell them when one specific part is going to fail. So it essentially eliminates the need for mechanical, the possibility of mechanical failure. Because what happens in the aviation industry at the moment is that, you know, you send your planes for maintenance and servicing on a regular schedule, right? But what if one of those parts fail before or after the mandated schedule? And I found that was particularly interesting because immediately after MH370, I thought, you know, what, we don't know what happened, right? So if we had all these parts talking to each other, could, you know, can aviation disasters be prevented?
Yeah, I think that the airline maintenance industry, it would have their own rigorous methods of seeing to the fact that their planes would be completely safe.
Yeah.
I think this would be yet another factor that would allow us to become safer, allow travelers to be completely safe. But yet another factor that would make us run out to have the machines take away our job.
And, well, we'll find other jobs, Jules. I don't think a machine can do this job.
Oh, the radio job, the radio, you never job. Know.
They
remember
might,
Max,
the voice of Siri.
Max Headroom in the 80s, who was like a computerized DJ or something. Or maybe there was actually a human behind it.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe Siri might take over my job.
Yeah, exactly.
Her voice is far better. But just coming back to the semiconductor industry with Vitrox Berhad. Now, we're going to be speaking to the CEO, Chu Jin Wing, to find out more about what it takes to send such a niche industry to greater heights. That's coming up at 8 o'clock in just a couple of hours. Ibrahim Sani will be doing the breakfast grill then. And after the grill on current affairs today, we look at jobs for refugees. Because despite the 150,000 refugees that are currently in Malaysia, according to UNHCR numbers, they are still without legal access to employment. And many of these refugees are not able to support themselves and their families sustainably. So I believe the Deputy Home Minister had recently raised the possibility that refugees, I think Rohingya refugees, would finally be given legal access to the job market. Oh, so today on Current Affairs, we want to discuss what that means for the Malaysian economy. You know, the concern is that will these refugees come into the market and take away jobs from citizens, right? Mm-hmm. Malaysian citizens.
Well, they're already there and we are employing a lot of foreign workers as well. So why not integrate them into that employment ecosystem? I think it would be great for us and great for them as well.
Do you think the fear is unfounded? That, you know,
I think so.
That Malaysians will worry, given the current employment situation, I mean, we see so many people out of jobs at the moment, right? And
yeah.
These refugees are not necessarily uneducated refugees. They could be, you know, middle class refugees who have had an education or displaced from where
some
they
of them
from.
Would yeah. be. Yep. And there is a very high incidence of graduate unemployment. So that would be a concern. But I guess a lot of them also want a stab and a chance at the good life, if not escape from the kind of hardships that they have at home. So they probably wouldn't mind doing a lot of the 4D jobs.
Yeah, 3D jobs.
3D or 4D jobs that Malaysians don't want to do. And I guess they would be very, very happy doing it. This is not a case of exploitation, but this is just a case of equal rights being accorded to the refugees.
Yeah, giving them an opportunity, right, a chance at the employment market. Well, let's find out more on Current Affairs, 8:35 a.m. And later on in the show at 9:35, the S&M show comes on and we'll be taking a look at whether dividend stocks are all they're made out to be.
It's such a huge trend now. Everyone is saying go for dividend stocks as though they wield some kind of magic. I guess it satisfies both sides of the equation, where one side thinks that the world is getting more and more risky, and so dividend stocks become the panacea to cure all your fears.
These are stocks, you know. These are equities
stocks,
still.
Yeah. And the other side is
seen as a safe haven.
Safe haven, right? Which is crazy. And the other side of the equation are people who are looking for yields, hunting for yields, and these could be your traditional bond investors or bond traders going into dividend equity stocks, which I think is also a cause for concern.
Okay.
So we'll be discussing more of this.
Well, let's find out more at the S&M show, 9:35 a.m. But very quickly, let's take a look at the news. Now, yesterday, once again, Bank Negara issued a statement on capping housing loan tenures at 35 years, because I believe there was some feedback or backlash regarding the property developers' money lending license, and they're asking, you know, the public saying, okay, well, Bank Negara, think about extending the tenure of loans from 35 to 40 years. However, the central bank has come out to say, if you do that, if you extend a loan to 40 years, it would only serve to add to the total cost of financing without significantly improving the affordability in your monthly installment. So the idea is, if your loan is longer, you pay less in terms of your installment. But Bank Negara is saying, actually, no, you just add to your financing cost.
Yeah, that's. I'm just thinking through this, and I think there is a difference between the nominal value, which is the actual ringgit amount that you would pay to the bank, between that and the actual value of those payments. Because as you extend the payments into future periods, the value of that fixed amount gets smaller and smaller and smaller because of inflation. 2,000 ringgit, for example, being used today to pay your installments will not be worth the same 2,000 ringgit in 30 or 40 years' time.
Right.
And in fact, if you extend the loan to, let's take an extreme here, 150 years, that 2,000 ringgit would be worth almost nothing in 150 years' time. But your income, the theory is that keeps
increase.
Growing, right? So that particular interest payment becomes cheaper and cheaper.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know if I agree with Bank Negara, but I certainly think that for a person who's earning an income and that income is growing, they would probably benefit from lengthening the loan tenure from a value viewpoint.
I find it fascinating that Bank Negara has yet again had to issue a statement on this. This is the third time they've had to issue.
They feel very strongly about this.
Yeah, they do. And I think it's because The public, they feel like the public doesn't get it, or because this issue won't go away. And for me, that's the bigger problem. The fact that this issue just won't go away, it doesn't seem to be resolving itself, no matter what Bank Negara says, no matter what the authorities say, housing ministry or the property developers, it doesn't seem to be going away because the problem of affordability is there. We've had banks weighing in to say that, you know, it's not their fault that they're not approving the loans. It's the fact that the loans have been rejected because of certain criteria.
Yep.
Bank Negara now weighing in to say that we cannot increase the tenure of loans. And property developers saying, well, you know, let us give buyers the top-up loans. It doesn't seem to address the affordability problem. At the end of the day, we just can't afford to buy houses. We can't
Correct.
Afford to pay it on our pay scale, right?
And Bank Negara is not the right institution to look at the affordability problem. That is something that the federal government has to look into, because that involves national policy. Bank Negara is involved in monetary policy, so that's not really under the purview. And the way the developers are harping to Bank Negara to do something to kind of give the property sector a jolt, I guess they are kind of barking up the wrong tree, because Bank Negara is not in a position to help them. Which is why I think there is this other statement here that Bank Negara is dismissing the suggestion that access to financing is the main problem confronting buyers. They are basically saying, hey, that is not our problem. You've got to increase incomes to increase affordability.
So when property developers, for instance, go to Bank Negara and say, hey, your lending requirements, your lending rules are so strict that people can't afford to buy our properties, you think that that anger or that is misdirected, because it's not the central bank's, mandate to spur the property sector?
Yeah. Well, I think that for anybody's reasonable lifespan, 35 to 40 years is a reasonable amount of time for you to repay your loan, and extending it by another 5 years, Bank Negara is right in saying that it might not make any difference. So perhaps I would suggest that the property developers ask for extending it from 35 years to something that's longer, to 60 years, for example.
Wow.
Because the net
that's
present...
That's more than, our working life, right? That would go into death, perhaps.
Yes, I'm going to use a technical term here, the net present value of what you're paying in terms of those fixed installments that you pay to the bank would become smaller and smaller and smaller as you go into time. So you can actually dipping into your retirement to pay off a rent that is decreasing in value.
It's a fascinating topic, one we will have to unpeel layer by layer, but this story is not going to go away for sure. We'll come back to that, but first, there's also news that in the US, new federal guidelines there have made it clear that while the government will provide some oversight, it wants to encourage the development of autonomous vehicles, self-driving cars. Now, this is one of the biggest signals that the US government has sent to the car industry, that it embraces the fact that self-driving cars are the way of the future.
You see, the robots are really taking over. So what will we be talking about?
Yeah, that's true. Well, just one official from the government said, we envision a future where you can take your hands off the wheel and your commute becomes restful or productive. So there you go. No longer, I mean, when I think of self-driving cars, I still think of the need to be vigilant and pay attention.
Yeah.
So all these sensors and computers will help me drive more safely.
For now.
But the idea is for you to sit in the back seat and maybe read a book or take a nap and then arrive at your destination.
Yeah. I think technology has crept up on us in ways that we don't expect at all. For example, the uproar and the furor caused to the taxi drivers by Uber and Grab, and which, by the way, Grab has obtained another round of funding, $750 million. You know, very proud that Malaysia has its very own unicorn, even though Grab is headquartered in Singapore. We're still going to claim it. I think some other people are, Singapore is claiming some other people's nasi goreng, but we are claiming Grab, right? That's homegrown. But technology is so creeping up on us. That I saw this at the news that a US judge has declared that Bitcoin is actually money. So, we're all blindsided.
So it's legal tender in the eyes of this
court. It didn't use those words, legal tender. I think you're very sharp here, Melissa. But I think what the judge is saying that Bitcoin qualifies as money.
Wow.
And this is really blindsiding us, right? Self-driving cars, seeing machines, and all these things are blindsiding us out of our complacency, our apathy. You know, these machines can do a lot more in ways that will affect us in extremely profound ways.
Okay, 6:15 right now. We'll be back with more news after this. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris with Julian Ng this morning. 6:22 right now. And remember a couple of months ago, Jules, we spoke about this hawker stall in Singapore that won...
Chicken rice stall
that won a Michelin star award.
Ipoh Mali.
Was it Ipoh? Was it from Ipoh? Is he from Ipoh?
Yes, but he's working in Singapore and he got that recipe from Hong Kong. So truly global, regional hawker man.
And he was the first guy to get a Michelin star for a hawker stall. So, I mean, really quite making headlines there when he won that Michelin star.
And it's the cheapest hawker hawker stall in the world. Only $2 Sing dollars a day, a meal.
Quite crazy. There you go. However, he's been making headlines again recently because he has now confirmed that he is in talks with 5 companies over a possible partnership, perhaps to sell his recipe. I don't know. Would you consider it selling his recipe? He wants to go into merchandising, basically.
I don't know. I think it's all very easy for us to be armchair judges here, right? Armchair judges. But this is a value judgment that he has to make for himself. And it's $2 million. Come on, guys. It's a lot of money.
So what is it? So he wants to essentially kind of work with partners to, I don't know, make chicken rice stock or chicken rice prepackaged.
He's just
food
selling the recipe, which is supposed to be secret.
But that's what has gotten you the Michelin star. I don't know how I feel about this. As a part of me, when I read this story, I felt like he was selling out. I felt like, oh man, you had such a good thing going and now you want to kind of sell out and create, stuff on the
but,
that I can get
but
in
you
the
see,
grocery
we,
store.
But you see, we are all extremely guilty about this as well. You know, we caused the selling out, the perceived selling out of this guy. You and me, we did it because,
why?
You know, after getting that Michelin, 90% of his customers became tourists. Only tourists went to visit his stall. And this is really not about the heritage status of this guy. This is really about us going out there seeking the most trendy food, right? Whenever we see UNESCO heritage according a status to some city, we flock there and we change the life of those people, the locals who are living there. We totally destroy the heritage, the living heritage of that particular location.
Yeah. I'm thinking about Penang.
I'm thinking about Penang too and Malacca.
Yeah.
So is this guy at fault? I mean, he's just playing the same game that we are, you know, buying into that whole tourism status trend. It's really not about livelihood or about heritage.
Yeah, okay. So maybe he's just making the best commercial decision for him and his
business,
right?
Yes.
But when I thought about him selling out, I thought about, what about all the other Michelin star chefs? So all the Anthony Bourdains and the Jamie Olivers of the world who have Michelin stars. I don't know whether Jamie Oliver does, but you know.
I'm not sure if Anthony Bourdain does.
I think he does. I think, what's his name? Gordon.
How can he?
Gordon
he just goes
Ramsay?
Around the world eating food. Vietnamese pho in...
With Obama, that's right.
How can he have the time to maintain his stars?
Well, when I think about them, I think, I don't see them as selling out. And why is that? So that's for me, that's something that I have
because they have done it a long time ago. So they've already gone past that. And I guess being international chefs, they will appeal to some idea of something that is very accepted and normal in our heads. But a hawker stall is sacred to our way of life. And selling out is essentially changing our way of life.
I have to ask you, if you could get Mr. Chan Hon Ming's chicken rice stock at your local grocery store, would you still queue up to buy his $2 Sing dollar plate of Chinese chicken rice.
If I could get his recipe.
Yeah, well, because essentially what he's doing is he's working with all these commercial companies to put his products on in stores, right? So make it available to a lot more people. So let's say if we could buy his chicken rice somewhere else, would we want to go to Singapore and experience this hawker stall for itself?
Well, you know, what you have just said, I thought about it as well, because I don't think that the guys who bought the recipe would be able to replicate it fully. So
I think this guy
has all the cards on his chest, on his sleeves, and he's possibly smarter than the buyers of the recipe.
Well, right? He wants to make his brand a second KFC. Now, I'm really worried about that. Does that mean like franchising? Because if I can get that in every corner, why would I want to go?
When you're at the top of your game, you wouldn't want to equate yourself to KFC. Why would you do that?
It's a fast food product, but you know, I don't think he has any lofty ambitions to pretend that he's a fine dining store since he is a hawker stall.
No, I think it's the wrong marketing strategy. You don't want to equate yourself to KFC. I mean, come on, you are producing very good food. And I think this guy may be smarter than we think he is, because he's selling out for 2 million and these guys wouldn't be able to replicate the recipe. Perhaps later on he would be able to buy them back for, you know, $2,000 or something.
Well, you know, foodies around the world are not just limited to fine dining or hawker stalls. You can find good food anywhere. And we came across this article from NPR that shows that you can find even great food within trains in India. So this, when I read this story, I have to say, I've never been to India and I've never been on one of the trains in India, but I did take a train to Thailand once, and it has a similar feel to it. You know, when they stop at these little stations, locals will come up and sell you stuff that they've prepared at home. And, you know,
and they walk along the aisles of the train.
Yeah. And I remember a friend who was traveling with me said, well, don't buy it. Don't eat it, because, you know, you never know how they prepared it or whether it's clean. And I thought to myself, well, this is the most local, authentic food you can get. I mean, we're talking about like little kampongs on tiny little train stops, right? And I remember having some of the most delicious Thai desserts while I was on this train. And that was
wonderful.
That was the best part of the trip, to be honest with you. I didn't enjoy the train ride at all.
Yeah. And why were you taking a train to Thailand?
Just for fun. It was just
for a holiday.
Yeah. It was an exchange program. So
nice.
It was the cheapest way to travel when I was a student.
See, those kind of rides would serve the local life, the local community, when carrying out their everyday duties. It's not generated by a UNESCO heritage status or anything,
right? Yeah, it's authentic, right? It's genuine.
It's serving the local population. But going back to that India story, this author of a story from this website called The Salt, he's lamenting the fact that those guys who are plying the train, serving the train route, that rich food culture that comes out of buying food out of trains is disappearing.
Oh.
Because of developments and because of other regulation that the Indian government is imposing. And he's saying that that's a sad thing.
I have to say also, similar to the train into Thailand, the express trains, because they don't stop at these tiny little train stations anymore. So that doesn't give the opportunity for the locals to come up and sell you their goods. And I think that's a sad thing. In our rush to get to the destination of the bustling Bangkok, right, you miss all the little stops along the way.
Yeah, now we buy our food from a cart that is being pushed on the aisles of a budget airline, right?
And we're paying. you can buy beforehand. Yes, when you buy your ticket.
Exorbitant amounts for it.
Okay, we've got the news bulletin next, BFM 89.9. Hello and good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. 6:41 right now. It's Wednesday, the 21st of September. I'm Melissa Idris with Julian Ng this morning. Now, across New York City on Monday, cell phones citywide blared with the emergency alert tone. So everyone with a smartphone got this message that read, "Wanted. Ahmad Khan Rahami, 28-year-old male. See media for picture. Call 911 if seen." So basically, it was like an Amber Alert. You know the Amber Alert when children go missing or when there's bad weather. So this message was released by New York authorities. and it's part of the Wireless Emergency Alert System, WEA, and it's believed to be used for the very first time as an electronic wanted poster. And, you know, what happened was that for everyone from commuters around the city to just, you know, teachers, school teachers and people working in the city, they were all enlisted as part of this manhunt. Millions of people were now on the lookout for this Rahami guy. And just a couple of hours later, he was identified and arrested by cops. So US media now saying that this is a success, you know, this was used, this is a sign of how technology can help with the war against terror. But it is quite a scary idea to have access to this technology. What if it's abused? What if they got the photo wrong? What if the wrong person was identified? Think of the, what could happen then?
Yeah, I think it is understandable why many people would fear this kind of development, because this is really trial by street people, you know, and this rising fear of vigilantism that we see in the Philippines, you know, so many people being killed because those kind of killings are sanctioned by the head of state, no less. But is there a middle ground to it? Because this is really... the criminal justice system crowdsourcing from the people.
I thought so too. I thought this was crowdsourcing a way, like, you know, if they needed to find him, how is he going to hide if everyone in New York City had a photo of him on their phone? But, you know, just reading this article, this is from the New York Times, and they spoke to different people, a professor of geography at the University of Southern Mississippi who has studied the alert system, this wireless emergency alerts. Now, she says that the alert was very unspecific and open-ended. By encouraging people to go to the media to look at that photo, what if someone had identified the wrong person?
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing is that the message, because it was limited to 90 characters, it was quite confusing. So, and fear-inducing. So what can happen with these kinds of mass alerts or crowdsourcing is the message can get lost in translation. What you think you are telling people essentially can incite panic and fear-mongering among the public.
I think this incident also shows that the Americans are quite trusting of their regulatory institutions. Really, for this to work, you must have the people being in one mind with whoever is issuing this kind of broad statement. And I think it's a reflection of the psyche of the people over there in America right now, who are very suspicious of...
Fear, right?
Who are fearful, who are really fearful of the terrorism that exists. I think, the bombings as well as 9/11 is still fresh in the minds of these people. So it showed the speediness of really getting into the act of hunting for this guy.
I'm two minds about this. I think it was completely efficient because under a couple of hours, this guy had been identified and arrested. So, you know, before he could cause any further harm or before he could, flee, he was arrested. But on the other hand, when you read this story, it talks about how people of Arabic descent were very, very worried. So they went to check out the photo to see whether they had any resemblance. There was one man who was really worried because he said he looked like the guy. Mm-hmm. So what if, like, the court of public opinion, as you said, Jules, had arrested him in their vigilantism and said, oh, you are the suspected bomber, right? So it's really hard to, I think, to leave this up. And this comes back to citizen journalism, right? Should you crowdsource journalism to people who are on the ground, mm-hmm. or should you leave it to the professionals, yeah. people who are trained, who are versed in the ethics of journalism?
I think it's more beyond journalism. It's also a case of the power to arrest, right?
Citizens arrest, yeah. Exactly. So, you know, but authorities kind of crowdsourcing this, I have a problem with that because... Well, they are the ones who are supposed to be, I guess, making that life or death decision in a split second, right? To leave it up to the public who can often get, you know, influenced by mob mentality, it's a really quite terrifying thought.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think it raises a lot of issues about personal safety and personal privacy, security and so on, because recently the Slate website ran a story about what is the best way to cover your webcam. And when I saw the headline, I got really worried looking at the webcam on my computer.
Is your webcam covered?
It's not at this point in time, okay. Because I thought that as long as that green light is not switched on, then I'm safe. No one is looking at me. But apparently, Mark Zuckerberg himself is covering his own webcam on his own computer.
Yeah, so that photo went viral, right? Remember, he took a photo and it showed that on his laptop, he had covered his webcam with tape. And recently, the FBI director, James Comey, also reaffirmed a position he has expressed in the past, claiming that he covers his computer camera with tape. And he says that, "I think people should take responsibility for their own safety and security." Now, when I read this story, I had a paranoid moment. I thought, oh my God, I should be covering my camera, right? Then I thought, well, who would want to see this? Yeah. Am I being overly paranoid? Because I don't want to cross into that line where I am worried about nothing or paranoid that everyone's out to get me.
Yeah. But anyway, down to practicalities, Slate actually evaluated a few options for you and they ranked it according to little human busts. The more busts you have,
the more, like a star rating ranking.
So Post-it notes, that's one. So very low. Duct tape is three. Painter's tape. I'm not sure what this is.
It's when you put the tape on and then you paint so the edges remain quite sharp.
That's quite strong. That's 4 stars. That's 4 stars for painter's tape.
Because it comes off cleanly. See, because I would worry that duct tape will have that stickiness. So perhaps I think with painter's tape, it's quite clean. It can come off without, you know, destroying your expensive laptop.
Cute cat stickers. That's just 2 stars. 2-star rating for safety. But 5-star rating for cuteness. So that's something to consider
if you want to have something cute on your
computer.
All right. Would you, after reading this article, would you cover your webcam now, Jules?
I think I might have to. I don't want people to see.
Do you use it, though?
I don't want people to see what I do in front of my computer.
Ooh.
You know, I would have to cover it.
Now I want to know. Now I'm curious what you do.
Now you're going to hack into my computer?
Possibly. I think I think it's time for you to bust out those cute cat stickers now, Jules. I think I would be thinking about putting tape over my webcam, given, you know, if the FBI director
and Mark Zuckerberg and the fact that Slate, which is, I think, a thinking website running this review of what's the best way to cover your computer, I think something's going on here.
Do you not think it's borderline paranoia?
It can be.
I mean, we're not Mark
Zuckerberg. In today's world, you can't be too safe.
I agree. Okay, there you go. Tell us if you would do it. Would you put tape over your webcam? And if you would, what's the best way to cover it? Would you do it with cute cat stickers or duct tape? Tell us. Hashtag TellBFM. Twitter handle is @BFMRadio.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.